I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Well, today on the podcast, you are in for, I think, a treat. Of course, you know what? I don't really know Christopher Smith. I hope we're in for a treat. I'm sure that we are, because I love the topic that he is writing about in his current book. It's called How the Body of Christ Talks, Recovering the Practice of Conversation in the Church. And if you know anything about me, you know I love conversation. Well, look, the podcast is titled Faith Conversations. I'm all about the conversation. And just ask my husband or son, and they will wax on that I never run out of questions, and I just sort of never run out of words. But I do leave room for others to talk. I would have to, or I wouldn't be a spiritual director, right? You've got to listen. That's a part of the conversation, is listening. So I'm excited about this. Couple of quick things. Some of you some of you email and say, I don't talk about or tell how to support the podcast often enough, or I don't give you the information slowly enough. So you can support Faith Conversations via PayPal, and the email address to use to give a gift there is producer@anitalustria.com. Okay, producer@anitalustria.com. Okay. All right, let me introduce Christopher Smith. He's a writer, community developer, founding editor of the Englewood Review of Books. He has authored or co-authored several books. I really enjoyed one of his books, which was an award winner, Slow Church. And he lives on the urban Near East Side of Indianapolis. So longtime member of Englewood Christian Church, which is a congregation, I think this is worth mentioning, that has been learning to talk together for over two decades. And I don't think a lot of congregations can say that. So, Chris, welcome to Faith Conversations.
Good morning, Anita. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And can I call you Chris?
Yes, please do.
Okay.
I see Christopher Smith as the author name because there's so many Chris Smiths.
Absolutely. I get that.
I go by Chris.
All right. Just check it. This is a topic, I already mentioned it, near and dear to my heart. My husband and I will often talk about this when we're going to just casual gatherings. You know, I'm not even talking about this in our church context, though this is certainly a very relevant topic there, in which you talk about in detail in the book. But that conversation in general is a lost art, and we'll go someplace and we'll come home and in the car, and we'll look at each other and go, did anyone ask you any questions? Nope. How about you? Nope. You know, and so I don't know what that's all about. Maybe we'll uncover some of that as we get into the content of your book. But why, you know, an author, there's always a reason why we write books. Why sure. This topic, and why now for you?
Well, this is a book that I've wanted to write for probably over a decade. Certainly comes out of our experience of talking together here at Englewood. And really, the main reason was to invite other churches, other Christians into the practice that has been most transformative for us as a church. Not only just most transformative, but also most life-giving for us, and to really want to share that with others was the impetus behind writing the book largely. And I also found that it's not just us, but there's a growing movement of congregations across North America that in one way or another are intentionally learning to talk together and wanted to share their stories as well.
What do you think moved churches that direction? Was that out of frustration or realization that this is not happening, or that people are absolutely missing each other in conversation, or just dialogue doesn't exist in the church context?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that congregations are kind of coming into conversation in various ways. I actually wrote a piece for Christianity Today that ran a few weeks ago that kind of told the story of four of these churches that I talk about in the book. And they all kind of came into conversation in a different way. Some of them are wanting to try to figure out kind of where are we going. And so they may find an opportunity to have some intentional conversations about where they've been and how that might shape where they're going. Other congregations have developed conversational ways of formation. There's a church particularly that I talk about in the book and in this Christianity Today article in Seattle that has a catechesis program, a way of introducing new people to new members to the church. And that's like a year-long process. And it's basically a year of intense conversations that potential members go through with already existing members in the church. And they it's a pretty amazing thing. So there's all that to say, there's a number of different ways. And I think that in a lot of ways, many people are hungry for conversation. They're hungry. There was a book that came out a number of years ago, I think about millennials, called You Lost Me. It was a Barna book. But I think that, I mean, the reason that a lot of people feel lost in churches is that they're not seen, they're not heard. There's not places for them to be in conversation and to be known and to know others. And I think there, in a lot of churches, there's a hunger for conversation, or at least hunger for the sorts of things that conversation can bring about.
You know, it's interesting. For a lot of my professional years, I did live radio, and I really enjoyed that because of the possible interaction with live callers, people calling in to the program. And and when I was doing it too, somewhere along the way, you know, social media was born, and so we could also get direct feedback during the program through comments on Facebook or tweets, you know, whatever, using Twitter. So that opened up one avenue of conversation, which I liked, but I still realized that it largely was the conversation that I was having or my co-host was having with the guest on that on any given day, and people were listening in largely. And I kept thinking, how can we bring more people into the conversation? How can we model it a little bit better? So we started doing something one day a week where we would have four people around the table, and each one would bring a topic. The show was an hour, so 15 minutes basically per topic, and with the possibility that one could go long, and you know, we skip a final topic, or and sometimes we would bring a song and talk about it, and you know, etc. But what was in, because one of the things in my heart was also to model how to disagree well.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And we didn't always disagree, but we worked at trying to disagree, you know, yeah, kind of funny. But what was interesting the first few weeks of this, and I want to get your comment on this, the first few weeks of doing this, negative reaction. Everybody wanted us to land the plane neatly and nicely with everything all in order and all agreement. And they didn't like it. They were, you know, negative emails, maybe within the first month. And then all of a sudden, the tide turned and it became the most popular day of the week of our programming.
That's fascinating. Certainly, I'm not surprised by the initial reaction. I think the culture that we live in, Western culture, really has an averseness to messiness. And I talk about that some in the book. So I'm not surprised that people were unhappy at first, at least, that things weren't resolved, with this new way of having conversations together on your show. But it is interesting to me that, folks, eventually did kind of turn around and that it became, really, really popular.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. And you said something, and I just want to touch on it briefly. You said in Western culture. And so I appreciate that you said that because I have narrowed it. And you're probably more accurate in saying that. I kind of narrowed it to more conservative Christian culture not being comfortable with, you know, when things don't just flow and fall into place really neatly and with disagreement. But maybe it's more Western than just Christian and conservative Christian.
So my background's in philosophy, and I love history too. And I mean, I think a lot of kind of the modern age, the last 500 years or so, really has been very much focused on order, on black and whites, but a lot of that is starting to fall apart. A lot of the order that we imposed on the world in the modern age that benefited certain people more than others probably is starting to fall apart. And I think that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it also puts us in a place where we are starting to have to deal with a lot more messiness, a lot more things that are unresolved, things that aren't necessarily always kind of fitting neatly into categories.
Yeah. And we need to deal with this societally, but I think the church could lead the way.
Absolutely. That's my hope. And that's why I'm offering this. I think that as we develop habits of talking together, and as one of the things that happens, I think, as maybe your experience kind of gives witness to, is that as we're learning to talk together, we're also perhaps learning to live with all the sorts of messiness of life that surround us. And I think that there's really good opportunity here for the church to be a leader culturally.
So where do we start? I mean, obviously your book is titled How the Body of Christ Talks. I think I've always thought, oh, but it needs to start on an individual level. How we're wired certainly contributes to whether we are easier in the conversational model than others. You know, personality drives some things, but you're starting straight up with the church, and which I appreciate. So, you know, where do we start when you're looking at the church body, at individual churches? And I would love for you to talk about what you have done at your church and what's being modeled there. Because I think that's how we learn. We watch and see.
Sure. So let me answer the why question first, or why churches. I think, and I'll try to keep this brief, but the central metaphor of the book is the human body and the ways that we exist as humans as conversation of diverse members of diverse parts of our bodies. And I believe that precisely in this way, we reflect the nature of who God is and indeed the life of God into which we are invited as humans. That said, also, I think a similar or analogous thing is true of our social bodies, the communities to which we belong. We are most healthy in those communities when we are able to talk together and work through difficult issues and imagine where we're going and how we're going to have the resources to move in those directions that we hope to go. So that's kind of the backdrop. But I think most importantly, or maybe a couple reasons more specifically about why churches. So certainly I think it's important that we learn to practice conversation in a particular community and over a period of time. And I think churches provide those things. But one other thing that churches provide is habits, hopefully, or at least we have a tradition of habits of forgiveness and grace. And those things are going to be really important. They certainly were really important for us at Englewood in sustaining habits of conversation when things get really inflammatory and really intense. So that's kind of the nuts and bolts. I think there's good things that come when communities talk together in general, when neighbors get together and have conversations about things that are going on in their neighborhood and are able to sustain those conversations over some period of time. But I really do believe that my hope, the most transformative place for conversations to begin, or is our churches. And so at Englewood, we kind of stumbled into the practice of conversation almost 25 years ago. We, like a lot of evangelical type churches in the early to mid 1990s, we had a Sunday evening worship service that was kind of a light version of the Sunday morning service. And it was pretty much dying off at that point, as it did in a lot of churches, as that sort of practice did. But we were weird. We didn't want to give up being together on Sunday nights, but we knew we couldn't continue to do the same thing that we had done for how many ever decades before that.
Right.
So somebody had the idea, why don't we just circle up chairs in one of our multi-purpose rooms and have a conversation together? And we're like, okay, let's try that. We very rapidly realized that even in that day, which was pretty much pre-internet and definitely pre-social media, we didn't know how to talk together. It was really inflammatory. People were yelling at each other. People were really sarcastic with each other. Some people left the church altogether. Some people stayed part of the church but steered clear of those Sunday night conversations. Out of sheer stubbornness or whatever else, we continued week after week after week after week after week. And it continues even today, almost 25 years later.
I'm just going to interject, out of sheer stubbornness or or because the realization was, wow, we don't know how to do this. We had better keep at it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was certainly a sense of that, especially among some of the leaders that kind of really brought us to the table, as it were, for conversation initially. I think that they had a sense that culturally and theologically, this was really important for us.
I appreciate, you know, I'm a quote lover, and you know, you use quotes at the beginning of chapters, which I always like. But I like this one a lot, and I think because it's true, and at least true in my life, from Brené Brown. People are hard to hate. Close up, move in. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what that's the opportunity that the invitation that conversation offers to us is actually. And that, again, kind of from our experience at Englewood, after over two decades of conversation, we're not in a place where we agree about everything. Maybe we've come a little bit closer to agreement, but the sweetest fruit of our practice of conversation is that we are coming to know one another and coming to trust one another. And that's, I think that bears witness to kind of what Brené Brown is saying there, that there's something really excellent about that sort of intimacy of knowing and being known.
Totally. Totally. I speak to women in a retreat setting a lot. And one of the things I talk about, and I mean, you'll be nodding your head. You know, we go to church year after year, sitting in the same pew and greeting the same people, and we call them friends, but they're merely acquaintances because we do nothing with them outside of that hour or a little bit more on a Sunday morning sitting in the pew. But oh no, they're my friend. What do you know? You know, how are you cultivating that? How can you know? It's got to go beyond that sitting side by side to sitting face to face.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that it's kind of a sort of symbiotic relationship because on one hand, the more you get into conversation, the more that shift that you're describing happens. But one of the other things is also kind of more intentionally really imagining. And I talk about this later in the book, one of the last chapters of the book, actually, about the shift from becoming a religious community or being a religious community to becoming a real community. And that's, I think, related to the shift that you're talking about. Because in a religious community, we do come in, sit in the pew, consume whatever religious services are offered, and then we go back, and then we have 6 days of our real lives. But we've really, I think it's really important, and the people of God into which we are invited is something more than that. It's what I would call a real community, as a community in the most holistic sense. It's the people that we work with or play with, eat with. And again, not that we shouldn't do that with our neighbors or other friends that aren't necessarily part of our church, because I think that's healthy as well. But if we are completely disengaged throughout the week from the sisters and brothers in our congregations, I think we have some significant problems. So I think conversation can help us lead us in this direction of being a real community. But to the extent that we are actually doing other things together, it also will help make our conversations go smoother and give us a lot more things to talk about.
Yes. Yes to all of that. And I'm thinking when I left my old radio show, one of the reasons I kept going, started the podcast, is because I wanted a quality conversation at least once a week in my own life. So in some ways it was purely out of selfish motives, because I was moving to a new area and didn't yet know people. Mm-hmm. And still, my husband and I, only about 2 years in to a new church, are still in that getting to know you stage. Mm-hmm. And while we bring all of who we are to the table, and some of that is what you're talking about in the book, because we are conversers and question askers, etc. But I love the book because you've given me a whole lot more to think about. And I realize I don't know my church's story all that well. But I'm already there and plugged in. And I need to do a little bit of, work there. But, and I'm used to, so another thing I did when I left doing this, every day, I followed the lead of a dear friend of mine, who we worked together for years. She started a conversation group in her home. I followed suit and I did the same thing. Invited women in. We just did women, I asked a diverse group of women across the board, both racially, ethnically, socioeconomically, and asked each woman to bring a topic. And then I moved. I have this desire to start this again in a new location, but I want to hear more because you're making me think differently about it and more in the church context. So I want to talk about large groups. It can be kind of unwieldy in a large group. How did you do this in your church context? And maybe that's a place to start is with the fits and starts or stumbles, because that's that tends to be what happens when initially, right?
Yeah, certainly that was our experience, a lot of fits and starts and stumbling. So I've been part of Englewood here for 16 years. So I haven't been part of the conversation the full time, but I've been a part of it a long time. And pretty much the whole time that I've been part of it, our group has been probably 50 to 70 people, which is probably sociologically way too large of a group to have conversation together.
But that's an exciting number, though. I hear that and I go, wow, that's awesome. But yes, I hear your point. I'll let you keep going. I just had to say, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it is exciting that that many people want to participate. And we really do encourage we would love to have everybody in our congregation, and that 70 people is probably maybe 2/3 of the adults in our congregation. But sometimes we do things like break into smaller groups, and that does allow more people to contribute to the conversation, and then those groups come back together and share some of the things that they talked about. But all of our conversations are facilitated. We have a facilitator that helps to get us started, reminds us. Oftentimes we'll carry the conversation from 1 week to the next week, and the facilitator will kind of remind us what we talked about the previous week and kind of what the topic we're talking about that week. And then as the conversation moves along, if it starts to get too far afield, the facilitator will hopefully steer it kind of back to the question or topic that we're talking about. And so that's really, really helpful for us. And the facilitator sometimes plays the role of inviting certain people that may not be speaking to contribute. What are you thinking? And we do that specifically often with our youth. Everybody in our congregation from seventh grade up, age-wise, is part of the conversation. And that's one of the ways that we keep the younger folks in the conversation engaged, is to ask them a questions from time to time.
Well, and they're learning. They're seeing, they're learning, they're participating. I mean, what a great way to be modeling this with them engaged in it. I mean, it's, you know, full orbed. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is this can be, well, you alluded to this already. So, I'm sorry if I'm bogging down here, but I think this is where most of us are.
Sure.
I think a lot of churches are afraid, very afraid, maybe even more so in this day and age. To do something like this. I've even seen at my church, you know, yes, there's a topic presented and it's open for questions to the presenter, but we're not going to get a microphone in your hand. You're not going to hold a microphone. You know, you're not really, it's not going to be a conversation.
Right.
And there, I think there's big fear. And you said, you know, this was when we first tried this. And, you know, didn't necessarily know what we were doing. Things got heated at what, you know, shouting, and some people might have left, possibly, likely,
definitely,
you know. So, yeah, I think we're afraid. And so then we just shut it down and go, no, we're not going there. So how do we begin? You know, you have managed to, your church has kind of gone through the deep waters for us already, so that you can kind of keep us from having to drown and watch people go out the door, which some people will not like this. Some people might still do that. But where do we begin and how? Yes, maybe that's just it. Where do we begin?
I mean, I think a couple thoughts. Certainly, I think in a lot of church contexts, there might be some fear about this. I think a couple of things that may help to mitigate the fear. I mean, certainly there's always kind of the fear of the unknown, and there's always conversation done well, always has an element of the unknown in it. But I think a couple of things that can be helpful for us as churches is one, to really think of the conversation and talk about the conversation as an opportunity for prayer, that to remember that God is with us, and that as we are talking together as brothers and sisters, we are not just talking with one another, but we are also talking with God. And we're hopefully, to the extent that we are able to pay attention to the ways that God is leading us, hopefully it will shape our conversation, and hopefully it'll shape the way that we talk to one another. If we're really mindful of God's presence with us, are we going to be so quick to call names or to demonize somebody else? So I think that having that mindset, and kind of as practices of conversation are introduced, to talk about it in that way. I think the other thing that we've been really insistent about in our conversation is to have conversations that the way that we talk together should be oriented by the way of Jesus. That is the way of Jesus that prefers others to ourselves. Mm. And specifically, that conversation is not just about me and my agenda and what I want to see done or see us think or talk about, but it's about all of us together. And again, that, I mean, very practically works out in not having people kind of hog the floor, as it were. And a facilitator can help with that. In other ways too, hopefully if it's not about us personally, then maybe if we're mindful of that, we won't be quite as defensive.
I think that's
So there's a number of different ways, and I hopefully give some resources in the book.
Yeah, I was just going to thank you. I was just going to say you've got some great appendices at the back, some sample conversational ground rules, a whole bunch of things on conversational methods, because you do talk about some great conversational methods in the book, which were, that was really helpful to me. I was just kind of winging it. And then to read about these methods, I thought, oh, wow, of course somebody, you know, studies this stuff.
Sure, and most of those methods kind of come out of the business world, and they're great.
Right.
But they're oftentimes they're oriented toward particular kinds of conversation that may not work for all conversations.
Right.
But oftentimes, as churches are getting started, it's helpful to have a sort of method that provides some structure to how we're going to talk together.
Mm-hmm.
So I offer those kind of three particular methods.
And I appreciate that. I want to know who decides what you're going to talk about. I think that's a good question, one in which you talk about in the book. And you're not necessarily talking specifically about your scenario, but you're offering some great thoughts there on what might we talk about if we get together for something like this. Also, how long did you keep it to the hour scenario of a typical, you know, evening service that you were replaced years ago, or how lengthy was this, or is,
sure, I'll start
is
with,
this?
Yeah. I'll start with that last question.
Yeah.
So I don't forget it. Typically the conversation is about an hour, but there's often a lot of conversations that take place after the conversation.
Absolutely.
So sometimes people will stick around and keep talking for another 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 60 minutes.
Or if you're me, you head out for ice cream and keep talking.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And now, one of the things that we shifted with a couple years ago was that the Sunday evening service or Sunday evening conversation time, we moved right up to Sunday morning after our worship service.
Nice.
So oftentimes, as you were kind of alluding to, sometimes people actually go out to lunch together.
Sure.
And continue the conversations in that context after. Now I forgot. You asked another question.
What are you going to talk about? What do you talk about?
I think
people wonder
question.
That. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's lots of things that you can talk about from exploring a text that might be preached on in the sermon. But for us at Englewood, we actually have a team of people called our adult discipleship team that helps. And again, we take input from anybody in the congregation about things that we need to talk about and try to kind of arrange those and make decisions together about what would be the most fruitful use of the conversation time that we have.
Mm.
So I think initially as conversations are getting started, it might be a pastor or a Sunday school teacher or something that provides some ideas for conversations. But as the conversation goes along, to kind of open that up and allow people to make suggestions and maybe even for the group to make decisions about what do we want to explore more intensely.
I also want to know about group size. I mean, do you keep this the large group, or do you break up into tables, you know, smaller conversation groups?
Yeah, we do often break into smaller groups, and certainly that has the benefit of, especially since we are so large, of more people being able to speak into the conversation, and we found that to be really fruitful.
I'm thinking of the introverts in the group would much prefer
a small
group.
The introverts. One of the other things that we do that I think is really helpful for introverts and people that maybe just think a little bit more slowly on their feet, as it were, we do try to kind of send out an email through the week and say, this is what we're going to be talking about on Sunday. And maybe this is something that you might read to kind of get your mind going and to prepare to participate in the conversation.
Oh, I love
that.
So
we really do try to be attentive to that.
Priming the pump, if you will.
Yep.
That's great.
Yep, exactly. Yep. But we do split into smaller groups. But one of the things that we try, we think that the larger group is really valuable because it's kind of where we all cohere as a church. We don't want to kind of just kind of consistently keep the same sort of groups because they might kind of diverge over time. But we think it's important for those small groups to come back together and kind of share what they're talking about and have some degree of cohesiveness among all of us that are participating in the conversation as the church.
Is the larger group even a way, sort, I don't know, for lack of a better way to name this, of kind of, you know, taking the temperature of what's happening in the church or not?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think that that's a really good venue for, and one of the reasons that in some contexts, some church leaders might be afraid of conversation because they may not want to know what the temperature of the church is, or they may know that there's some things that are going wrong and they would prefer to avoid those. So I think one of the things that conversation does is that it does kind of unveil things that are concerning to some people. It does kind of help to give you an honest sense of, or more honest sense at least, of where the congregation is and what people are thinking. And I think that's good. I think because then you're actually, as you start to work with this, and whether it's encouraging or whether it's a little more problematic, you're actually dealing with real situations. You're not just kind of making assumptions about what you think people are thinking,
right.
But you actually know that, and you're able to engage in conversation and to try to figure out how to move forward in light of the real opinions and feelings that people have.
So I think one of the things that's coming to my mind, I'm remembering some groups I've been a part of, maybe sermon discussion type groups, where good questions weren't necessarily asked.
Mm-hmm.
And so the conversation did not move forward, and everyone sort of gave the same response. It was not conversation inducing. It was more what I realized, it was the equivalent of if you were going through a fill in the blank book study. It's like, this is not what I signed up for. I want real conversation.
Sure.
And I think maybe that goes back to the fear piece that, oh, but if I really open it up, what might get talked about, or what, well, that, you know, and that's a risk as a leader too, that you've got to take. And I'm going to add on maybe a harder question, but I'm sure you've dealt with it. Do you ever shift where the conversation originally was intended because of something that happened in the world or something that happened in the news? Or do you steer clear? Like, I'm thinking, I realize podcasts are listened to, you know, some months later, some are listening the week it's released. And so, you know, just the week previous to releasing this podcast, there was yet another school shooting. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, deep sadness, of course. Do you go with some of those big, heavy topics?
Yeah, we tend not to be too driven by current events, because there's always something coming up, always something that's really tragic,
right,
in the world. But sometimes those things do come up because people are thinking about them. They're on their minds. They're on their hearts. And oftentimes, just as the natural flow of conversation, those things come up, and we don't try to shut the conversation down because they come up. But also, we try not to let them completely derail what we're talking about. Really try to engage whatever the school shooting or a racial shooting or whatever else that are on people's hearts and minds. We try to engage them in ways from the perspective of what we're already talking about. But sometimes, I mean, once in a while, I mean, there are things that we just feel like we do need to take several weeks and have a longer conversation about. We had a conversation about race in the not too distant past. So there are some, from time to time, we do do that, but we do try to not just kind of be talking about a lot of the current events that are going on in the world, but in a lot of ways, our conversation for us is really trying to think about a lot of the hows and whys of how we live faithfully.
Right where you're planted, right where you're planted.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, yeah, it's complicated, but certainly when those things come up, as they inevitably do, because people are thinking about them, and we don't shy away from them, and we really do want to hear what's on people's hearts and minds.
How important is knowing the people's stories that are sitting around you as you're in the midst of the conversation? I mean, we all bring our brokenness to the table,
yeah,
and our individual stories. I know you talk about that. I don't know if you spend any time, you know, getting to know others' stories, or if that actually is something that just kind of comes out in the context of the greater conversation.
Yeah, I think more of the latter. Certainly, there's been times that we've very intentionally asked people to share stories from their past, and those go well. But I think it's more of the just kind of stories coming out. I think it can be dangerous to ask people to share stories when they're not ready to share stories. And I think that we try not to do too much of that, but more so try to model incorporating parts of our stories as we go along. Again, this may be part of good facilitation. When a facilitator can see that somebody may be particularly angry about something or particularly saddened by some part of the conversation, a facilitator may very carefully and gracefully, hopefully, graciously try to explore that. Like, why does this make you sad, or why does this make you angry? Hopefully, and again, somebody may not be able to be willing or ready to kind of talk about that yet, but sometimes people are able, willing to share a little bit. And again, some of those conversations may be conversations that kind of have to happen afterwards.
Sure. Yes, I get that.
In
too.
A little bit more intimate setting of just person to person, or maybe a handful of people.
Yeah. But
those are important. They're part of the process of helping us know one another and helping us talk better together over the long run.
And so that's like, you know, pieces of personal stories when they come out. But also you allude to this early in the book and say, I'm going to come back to this, you know, a cast on an arm, you know, the healing process, because you talk about the healing. In fact, I think that's a chapter of title of one of the chapters, The Healing Potential of Conversational Methods. And that's where you do get into a few methods that, as you mentioned, come from the business world, but can be, fashioned to work in other settings, certainly. But I think it's in chapter 9 where you talk about sustaining conversation through conflict. And that's where you come back to that that picture of, you know, what happens when we fracture a bone or something like that. How do we, and I know what you were just saying is that sometimes the conversation continues beyond the allotted time. And some of that may be because you're working to end things well. And I'm not saying that all of the gatherings have a component of conflict at all, but it's an inevitability at some point.
Sure, no doubt.
So how do you care for sustaining that conversation in the best possible way through conflict?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really good question. Certainly, you've kind of already alluded to this, but particularly when there's conflicts that come up between particular people, oftentimes we encourage them to talk to one another afterwards, and oftentimes now often people will just intentionally seek one another out and try to apologize or kind of talk through something that may have been pretty intense in the larger conversation. But I mean, I think sometimes, and one of the things that I talk about in this situation is that sometimes we may need to have kind of smaller or more structured or more intentionally curated sorts of conversations to help us be able to have larger conversations together as the church. I tell the story of my friends at Grandview Calvary Baptist Church in Vancouver, and they had various practices of conversation together for the church, and they do some really amazing things with listening together in prayerful conversation, and they've done that for a decade or more. But more recently, they've been kind of really facing some fractures in their congregation around questions about sexuality. And one of the things that they did in response to that, because they're part of a fairly conservative evangelical denomination that has traditional views on marriage and sexuality, but they live in an urban neighborhood, cosmopolitan urban neighborhood in Vancouver, where there's a high presence of LGBT people, both kind of in their neighborhood, but also in the congregation. And so how do they kind of navigate this really intense forces from their denomination, their history,
potentially divisive conversation.
Oh yeah, potentially. So one of the things that they did was they kind of structured this very intentional conversation where they picked about 12 people, I think, that were all accepted by the church as mature members of the congregation, mature in their faith, but at very different places on their perspectives on questions about sexuality. And they sent this group away on a retreat for a long weekend. And they really did exactly what you were describing of sharing their stories. They were encouraged to share their stories and share some of their experiences that might have led them to think one way or another about matters of sexuality. And what this more structured, kind of smaller, intentional conversation did for them was that it didn't kind of, again, make them agree about everything. But as they came back to the larger church, one of the people that participated in that conversation, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it said something along the lines of, we don't agree with each other, but after this retreat, we feel like we've got one another's backs. And I think that that retreat has been really helpful for the larger congregation because they see what went on there, and they see the ways that these people have really gone out of their way to listen to one another and to really prefer unity to agreeing on everything. And that's enabled them to continue talking and to continue making specific decisions that they need to make in order to be faithful in the midst of this confluence of different forces that are exerted upon their congregation.
I love that. The trickle-down effect of that, I'm sure, is huge. And what a beautiful way to do it, and wise way as well, to take a smaller group, but with people all across the spectrum of viewpoints and positions, etc. I love that story.
And I think those people that went on the retreat have since then played a sort of leadership role,
of course,
in the larger congregation, and they've certainly been looked to because they've had this kind of shared experience
together. What is your hope? You know, someone grabs a copy of How the Body of Christ Talks, I mean, what would be the best possible email you might get from someone after they've read your book?
Well, certainly, I absolutely love it. Just energizes me when I hear that a congregation has decided to create a space to have conversation together. And I want to be really clear that even though I'm talking about and focused on congregations talking together, I think that the real fruits of this, and I think it's really important that churches talk together, but as we are talking together, we take the skills that we're learning, the conversational arts and skills that we're learning, we take them into our neighborhoods, into our workplaces, into our homes, into the public square at large. And that's part of the witness, I believe, that we bear to the larger world. But I think the church, it's really important for the reasons that I said early on in our conversation, that we're able to extend grace to one another and forgiveness to one another. It's important that we are learning to do this in the church, and we have this community where we're regularly practicing conversation together. But that's not the end of the story. It's that we take these practices out with us,
right,
into all the avenues of life. Yes. That we find ourselves in.
Which, not to go backwards here, but all of a sudden I want to ask, did we used to do conversation better, or have we never really? I mean, is it something that's been lost along the way, or did it never really exist in a good way?
I think yes and yes to both of those. I mean, I think there are... again, as I said earlier, a conversation is a part of healthy communities. And I think there's an extent to which, and certainly there, some of the listeners may be familiar with the Harvard sociologist Robert Putnam, who wrote a really important book called Bowling Alone, mm-hmm. About how over the second half of the 20th century, a lot of the communities that had functioned previously in American culture, American society, were dissolving, and kind of the title image is of bowling leagues, which in earlier decades had really thrived.
Right.
And he said when he was doing his research in the 1980s and 1990s, that more people than ever were bowling. But they were bowling alone. They were not participating in bowling leagues.
Yes.
And that was kind of an image of kind of what was happening in a lot of the sorts of social groups, Kiwanis clubs, sports right. leagues, neighborhood groups, really saw a decline over the latter half of the 20th century. And I think with those decline in those social groups came a decline in conversation. Even something as simple as the diminishment of the family dinner table in homes over the last 50 to 75 years has a really detrimental effect on our capacity to talk together. And there's been some good work around that. But also, I think one of the things that oftentimes those communities to which people belonged were also very homogeneous yeah. communities.
Right.
And we're also seeing a shift where some of the communities that are starting to take shape in the 21st century are more diverse communities right. Where we're not just kind of seeking out people that have a shared interest.
Right.
So in some senses, it is also something new that isn't just kind of recovering what we had in the past.
Yes, yes.
But learning to talk together with people that actually are different from us,
yeah.
Different socioeconomic backgrounds, different political backgrounds. So it's not just kind of merely recovering what we had in the past, but it's learning to talk together, maybe as some communities did in the past, but doing it in kind of the more diverse world which we find ourselves in the 21st century.
I just feel like conversational practices and teaching on how to converse needs to happen in our schools.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that we're finding, certainly in our experience at Englewood. We have a local neighborhood school that we work with that we've kind of helped. It was a failing public school, and we kind of helped to gather a group of neighbors that kind of took over oversight for that school and to work with that school and providing some social services that are needed and really helping families to be engaged healthily in their children's education. But it's opened up a wide opportunity for conversations together within the school community, yeah. but also within the kind of broader community of families that participate in that school, yeah. in many of them in our neighborhood as well. I think schools could be a great place for people to learn practices of conversation, but you need people that have a vision for that, and you have people that have some background and have some practice with that. And our churches could maybe provide some of those people as we're learning to talk together in our churches.
I love that thought. Well, didn't mean to, that really wasn't digressing. It's all part of the greater topic and so much more here that we could talk about. But I thank you so much, Chris, for your time. Again, Christopher Smith, How the Body of Christ Talks, Recovering the Practice of Conversation in the Church. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Anita Date. Today, it's been a joy to talk to you.
Thank you. And to everyone else, as always, I say keep the conversation going.